06.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. When a person is mentally ill, the spotlight is often on them, their actions, their suffering, their need for medication and or psychotherapy. And just as often in the background is a family who suffers along with the ill loved one as they try to help, to cope, and sometimes agonizingly to let go. Rachel Pruchnow is author of Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. She's also professor of medicine at Rowan University's School of Osteopathic Medicine and director of research at the New Jersey Institute for Successful Aging. Rachel Pruchnow, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
This is such a heartbreaking story. Your mother and your daughter both suffered from mental illness. Your daughter still suffers from it. And we'll get to Sophie in a little bit, but let's start with your mom's story. Her illness developed at a time when people really weren't talking about such things openly.
Absolutely. My mother was diagnosed with manic depression when I was about 12 years old. And interestingly, she was in her early 40s. We had no idea. None of us understood what caused it. The doctors never talked to us. I always assumed that maybe they had talked to my father, but learned more recently that they hadn't talked to him. They hadn't talked to any of us. So we were really on our own, and my family really dealt with it by not telling anybody. This was so aberrant and so different that we just sort of functioned. We clung to each other and did the best that we could to maintain some semblance of normalcy. And my father did the best job that he could. You know, he was the sole breadwinner. But it was very, very difficult.
Her illness was often marked by the change of seasons?
It was. She, in the summer, she would fly high. She would be, leave me alone, I'm going to go read. And she would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and she would vacuum and have dinner cooked by the time I woke up. And the rest of the day was, she was reading these very scholarly books about the economies of China. She was actually trained as an economist. For a woman of that generation, born in 1923, she had a master's degree in economics, very, very bright. And So she just really turned inward. And that was the summer. As the fall approached, the depression would begin. And by the winter, she couldn't get out of bed. And she was suicidal. She threatened to commit suicide several times. I think by the time I was 16, I knew she was going to kill herself, but I didn't know when it was going to happen. And so I was always living on pins and needles.
What a burden as a child.
Horrible, horrible. And, you know, for my brothers as well. Yeah.
So how did this shape you as a child? Did you at times become the person who was taking care of your mother?
I did sometimes. I learned how to cook at an early age. We all really pulled together. My father did the best that he could, but, you know, he would check our homework. And you know, even though my mother was sick, and sometimes she would be hospitalized, she did the best that she could in terms of reading every essay I ever wrote and making sure I was doing my homework, and my brothers as well. You know, when she would go to the hospital, she would leave us this set of instructions, and she would freeze. If she had, you know, time, she would freeze food and tell us and leave us a list of things that we should eat. So she was really trying her best to care for us as best as she could.
So you never felt neglected?
Never. I didn't feel neglected. I felt scared. I felt, I would often, when I was falling asleep at night, have conversations with God and say, you know, at least if she's going to be sick, give her an illness like cancer or diabetes or something that people understand. You know, Mary, when people have cancer or diabetes, families and friends know, and they rally and they bring the tuna casseroles. And when it's mental illness, not so much.
Well, and as a matter of fact, after your mother committed suicide, you told people she died in a car accident. So there's secrecy.
I did,
and
yes.
And we touched on that just a little bit. But what went into that decision? Why secrecy? Shame? Stigma?
Shame, stigma. You know, when you say decision, I'm not so sure it really was a decision. It was the only option. I never thought about telling people. I think that the stigma about mental illness, and you know, now we talk about stigma. then in the 1970s, we weren't really talking about stigma. We were living it. We were living and breathing it, and we didn't talk about it because we knew that nobody would understand. I mean, how do you tell somebody that, you know, your mother committed suicide? And so I created this story that she had died on an icy road on a December evening. And that's what I told my friends, and that was the story that I stuck with for more than 30 years.
And yet that stigma still exists today.
Absolutely.
For people who are mentally ill and their families.
Absolutely. There is stigma for the person with mental illness, but also for the families, and I think that's so important. You know, I think now we're starting to talk about stigma in terms of encouraging people with mental illnesses to come out, and, you know, many of the movie stars come out and talk about their own mental illness. I think that's a good beginning. But the stigma that families face is amazing, to the point where, you know, now that I've written my story and told my story, I will run into people all the time, people that I've known for many years, who will pull me aside at a party and say, you know, I've never told anybody, but I have to tell you that my son or my nephew or my spouse suffered from a serious mental illness. So we're still not talking about it.
Does stigma stymie the movement forward for the mentally ill and their families as far as treatments, as far as rights, as far as progression?
I think it does. I think that stigma makes people keep secrets. If people keep secrets, then we can't even count the numbers of people who are affected. If we can't count the numbers, you know, when Congress goes to allocate money, how do they allocate money to something that they don't even think exists? We don't understand how huge this problem is.
And yet on the flip side, Rachel, it almost feels as if we spill too much in our society. Sometimes when I'll flip through the channels on the television, you know, I'll see a talk show and I'm cringing when I hear about what people are talking mm-hmm. about. Is that legitimate?
I think it is. And I think, you know, when I'm encouraging people to do is not to shriek from the banisters, you know, that I have a mental illness, but rather to tell one or two people to whom you feel close. You know, we know from the social psychological literature that it only takes one or two confidants to give people the support that they need. And that's what I think. I think that's the beginning. You know, I think it's not that I would discourage people from letting others know that they suffer from a mental illness, but I wouldn't recommend somebody saying that on a job interview or on a first date. I think that we need to really begin the dialogue, and I think the dialogue begins close to home with the closest of friends and being able to confide in one or two people to get the support, the natural support that exists. And that's the harm that I did to myself, because I told nobody. Imagine being, you know, in high school and having the secret. You can never bring friends home because who knows what mom's going to be doing. Mm-hmm. Is she going to be pacing? Is she going to be crying? Is she, you know, what's she going to be doing? So I totally shielded myself. And you know, advice to the next generation, don't do that. Confide.
You write that her death also brought relief. And also in the pages of your book, it's obviously that you cared about your mother very deeply.
I did. Very deeply. The relief in terms of I now knew when she would die. Because before that, from the time I was 12, 13, 14, I knew she was going to kill herself. She was just she would get so sad and so depressed that I knew it was going to happen. And so the issue was I now knew it happened, and now I can start to deal with it. I can move on.
In a little while, we will discuss, you know, the situation with your adopted daughter, Sophie, who suffers mm-hmm. from a similar illness. But do you think that if your mom had been diagnosed in 2014, she might have fared a little better?
I don't know. It's a tough question to answer. She was on medication. They did try electric shock with her. You know, we heard the warning signals and we responded whenever we could, but she was so determined not to be a burden to my father and to my brother and me, my brothers and me, that, you know, when somebody is that determined and that depressed, I don't know that it could have been stopped.
And she was in a lot of pain.
She was definitely in a lot of pain. And you know, I loved her deeply, and she did. You had asked earlier, you know, she influenced the career that I chose to go into. I knew I wanted to go into psychology to understand people like my mother, but I also knew I didn't want to be a clinical psychologist because I didn't want to be responsible for making sure other people didn't kill themselves.
Instead of collapsing under the weight of the worry for your mother, you're very successful.
Thank you.
How did that come about?
I think that certainly at the beginning, I used work as my sanity, and certainly with Sophie as well. I would go to work, and things would be normal, and I could control things, and I could write papers and develop grant proposals and study older people, and it was a very controllable world, and that probably was what saved me.
Your refuge.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you write that your mom was a good mother,
mm-hmm.
despite her mental illness. And so today, if you had to tell me about how you feel, how you view your mom, how would you characterize your mother?
I think she was amazing. I think, you know, she suffered terribly, and I'm very sorry for that. You know, I wish that the medications could have been better and the treatment could have been better, mm-hmm. and that we could have saved her. You know, I say in the book, I as a gerontologist, I wish that I could have taken care of her in her old age.
Later in life, you and your husband decided you were open to adopting a child whose family had a history of mental illness. And it's interesting. I mean, after all you went through with your mom, why?
You know, I'm a really stubborn person. And I think when my husband and I started talking about adoption, we were very clear about some of the babies that we would not adopt. We turned away several babies of drug addicts. We drew the line there. But when it came to mental illness, I really felt, you know, here I was now as a psychologist. I'm trained. I can deal with it. We don't always know just because there's mental illness in the family that this particular child is going to suffer. And I kind of felt like, okay, bring it on. You know, maybe I can do a better job. Maybe I can help. If in fact the child that I adopt does suffer from a mental illness, then who better than me to help this child?
So how did you come to find Sophie?
Sophie. We worked with an adoption agency, and at the time, the agency was in Pennsylvania. We were living in Ohio, and this agency allowed us to advertise. So my husband, a newly minted PhD in marketing at the time, wrote the ad and figured out which papers to advertise in, and we chose little towns throughout Pennsylvania. We put the ad in on July 1st of 1992. And on July 4th, as the fireworks were going off over greater Philadelphia, actually greater Cleveland, we were living in Cleveland then, the adoption phone line rang. And I was nearly asleep. Of course, the adoption agency had told us when this phone rings, it had a different ringtone so that we knew it was that phone as opposed to our home phone. When that phone rings, I was to answer it because many birth mothers don't want to talk to men. And so the phone line went off. I was half asleep, and I said, I can't do it. You have to answer the phone. So my poor saintly husband answered the phone and had this amazing conversation with our birth mother. The conversation lasted for about an hour, and I listened. A few days later, we actually met the birth mother.
And at that time, you did not know that there was severe mental illness in the family of the birth mother.
That's correct.
And we'll get to more of that in just a moment on Radio Times. Rachel Pruchnow is our guest. She is author of Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 888-477-9499, our email radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Back in just a moment.
International House Philadelphia supports WHYY. Events coming soon to International House. Martin Scorsese's Masterpieces of Polish Cinema, running August 14th through August 30th. Chaplin's City Lights on September 13th. And Billy Wilder's Academy Award-winning film, Sunset Boulevard, on September 20th. For a full listing of events and information, it's ihousephilly.org. International House Philadelphia, the hub of international culture.
Hi, I'm Stephen Quinn. Journalist Amanda Petrusich reveals the obsessive world of 78 RPM record collectors and how the largely white male demographic has changed our understanding of music history. That's coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Say goodbye to the GE building at 30 Rockefeller Plaza. Say hello to the Comcast building. Well, to one New York art historian.
Anything other than the RCA building sign is to me a certain kind of desecration of history. But history does get desecrated now and then.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times and WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. Rachel Pruchneau is our guest. She is the author of Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. Our telephone number is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is something that affects so many people, mental illness, families, the fact that many people affected by mental illness still feel they need to keep secrets. And also there are a great number of frustrations in getting the right treatment. We'll get into all that. But first, Rachel, Sophie's story. And again, before the break, we were talking about how you really didn't know that there was severe mental illness in her family history. And she does have bipolar disorder. You adopted her as a young child. She was exceptionally bright, wasn't she?
She was. We actually took Sophie home from the hospital. We were there the day she was born. She was an amazing baby. I fell in love with her immediately. She was sweet, cherubic. She had these big, beautiful cheeks. She learned to speak quickly, early. She walked early. My husband loves to dabble in science, and he would, if Sophie asked him to explain where shadows come from, he would give her a 5 to 10 minute treatise about shadows, and she understood. She used that knowledge, and she could not only repeat it back to him but apply it in other settings. Hmm. So there was a time when she was, maybe 4 or 5 years old, that we started thinking we were raising the next Einstein. She was so bright.
So when did the trouble begin?
Well, I think we started to notice that Sophie was different from other kids. You know, certainly by the time she was 6, 7, 8 years old. Mm-hmm. Hard to pin it down exactly. Here we were, first-time parents. I'm a gerontologist. What do I know about children? So you learn with your first child. When I look back, though, I think that there were probably hints of something different by the time she was 2 years old. I remember the first time when she got a flu shot. She was 2 years old. She was able to, this two-year-old was able to convince herself that the flu shot was not going to hurt. Hmm. And when she got the shot, there's all these nurses standing outside the door just watching her because she was incredibly adorable. You know, she just approached and said, "Do you have a flu shot for me, doctor?" And the doctor said, "Sure, I do." He proceeds to give her the shot. She didn't wince. She didn't blink. Not many other kids, I think, would do that.
Sure.
But that was just sort of the beginning,
Almost as if she could disappear into a bit of a fantasy world.
She could. Yeah. She could when she was 4 years old, and she had her teacher. The teacher thought she was adorable, but she was constantly disrupting. She would, sing in the corner. She would, when sent to the principal's office because she had misbehaved, the principal, she had worn, the poor little Sophie had worn a path to the principal's office, and the principal decided she was going to teach her a lesson. So she made her empty all the trash. She gave her the cool little gloves, and she made her empty the trash in all the classrooms. Well, by the end of the day, everybody else said, "I want to be like Sophie. I want to be emptying the trash." So she could make lemonade out of any lemons you gave her.
But then at age 11, she was at camp and catastrophe struck.
Mm-hmm.
And you did not realize what had happened until years later. But
that's
she,
right.
You tell the story.
Well, she was at camp. She was raped at camp. And she came home. She had a bruise on her cheek. And of course, my husband and I asked what happened. And she said, "Well, I was playing wiffle ball, and the ball hit me." And my husband is this analytic thinker, and he said, "Well, that's not possible. A wiffle ball couldn't do that." And he kept pushing and pushing and pushing and trying to understand what really happened. And Sophie stuck to her story of it was a wiffle ball. It wasn't until 5 years later and years of therapy and finally finding a therapist that she was comfortable with that we learned the truth.
Well, that is that normal, with quotation marks around it, for an 11-year-old to not confide in her parents about something like that?
Perhaps, but you'd think that it would come out somehow, that to be able to keep something like that a secret. The story that she told later was that he threatened her, that, you know, you tell your parents, I'll kill you. So she was threatened, but I think most kids would find a way to tell somebody, tell some safe adult, a doctor, a teacher, a somebody. But she didn't tell any adult until 5 years later.
But what happened then is her mental condition started to slowly go downhill.
I think that's safe to say. I think we really saw, we moved in when she turned 12, and I think that when we moved to New Jersey, we really started to see different behavior. And at first, you know, again, this is our first child in the tween age, the tween years, and starting to develop, you know, interest in boys, and so we were learning from Sophie what's normal, what's real.
But she became sexually active and in quite of a huge way very mm-hmm. young.
She did. She did. We didn't know it until much later, but she did. Yeah.
Was that a manifestation of her illness?
I think so. Now, you know, when we're talking about, she was diagnosed with ADHD in fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a typical path. She was then diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which used to be called manic depression.
Which is what your mother had.
Which is what my mother had.
Ironically.
Yeah, it manifested itself differently. Mm-hmm. Sophie's manic depression cycled much more quickly, whereas, as I said, my mother's was more seasonal and cyclical. Sophie's was more ups and downs, and Sophie was actually more manic, not as much depressed. So it was different.
Well, I was going to say one of the critical episodes in your life, your home life with Sophie, was you know, the internet, as many parents know, is a blessing and a curse. Mm-hmm. And in your household, it became a nightmare because she literally hooked up with some child molesters mm-hmm. online.
She did, more than once.
And she didn't really have a sense of how dangerous that was. So
right. That
was the illness speaking.
I think it was. The things that she did would frighten normal children and petrify adults.
Why don't you tell the story of Grinner?
Grinner. So Sophie connected up with this adult pervert when she was 15, 16 years old, and she figured out very quickly how to sneak out of our house. Now, our house is alarmed every night. And she figured out, she knew that there was one window in her room that was not alarmed. It was on the second floor. And she made a plan one night to sneak out. So she tied her sheets together, shimmied out the window, and he met her there. And he drove her to a hotel in Delaware. The next morning, by the time she appeared on my doorstep the next morning at 4:45, I think it was, and with this story about how she had felt claustrophobic and felt she needed to just get out of the house and that she went to a pond nearby.
Hmm.
And she stuck with that story. She, for years, she wouldn't tell us. And little by little, we worked with her therapist and we started to realize what was going on. And then we start playing a game of cat and mouse, trying to figure out how to help her.
Well, while this was going on, what was happening inside of you? I would have just about died.
It was amazing. It was seriously. We were playing the game of whack-a-mole. You know, you think you'd fix one problem and then another one would pop up. And more than anything, we're trying to keep our daughter safe. And she's just trying to escape and run to this pervert.
She thought she loved him.
She believed he loved her. And she was convinced that she loved him and they were going to run away together.
But you and your husband eventually became privy to those conversations online, and he did not love her. He, you know, was using her, and it was even a violent persona.
Yeah.
You were not able to do anything legally to get this guy to stop?
Well, it was difficult. We worked with Sophie's therapist, and we put in a surveillance system on the computer so we were able to monitor what was going on. And we did that because we knew if we told Sophie, if we tried to talk to her, that she would find a way to communicate with Grinner that we couldn't watch, and that as, when it went beyond talking, that we couldn't intervene.
Hmm.
Right? So we were in this horrible position of wanting more than anything to protect her. So as long as they were talking, as long as it didn't go beyond talking, at least we were monitoring it. When it did go beyond talking, we brought the police in and we got them involved. And even then, we had to persevere this thing without letting her know that we were watching her. Because the minute she knew we were watching her, she would borrow somebody else's cell phone, or she's very, very clever. And she would find another way to communicate with him.
And this was, again, her illness speaking and her lack of being in touch with reality. Yeah. I'd like to get to her medical regimen in just a moment. But first, I'd like to, our telephone lines are open. And for those of you who happen to be listening to the show, obviously mental illness is a lot more common in society than we think. If you have a loved one who suffers, what is your experience? We'd like to hear from you. 888-477-9499 is our telephone number. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Our guest today is Rachel Pruchno. She is author of the book Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. So Sophie is eventually, she's diagnosed and she is still a minor. Mm-hmm. So as a family, you were able to supervise her medications. What was she put on to help treat the bipolar?
Right. So she was diagnosed when she was a junior in high school. And at that point, they took her off the ADHD medications that she'd been on. So, of course, the first question is, did she ever have ADHD? I think she probably did. That explained a lot of her organization problems. And then they started to play around with the medications. They would try, she was on Abilify at one point, she was on Lamictal, she was on Zoloft. Part of the issue was for the psychiatrist to figure out which medications would be the best for her. She really was like a chemistry set. And then we would start down the road on one medication, and I was always monitoring. I was watching because I knew the first signs of Sophie's becoming manic-y. Mm-hmm. And then I would report it to the psychiatrist, and then she would either increase the dosage or add a new medication. So it was very much an interactive process between the therapist and me, trying to figure out what would work the best.
Yeah, the thing about mental illness is it's not like setting a broken bone. Really, right. It varies from person to person, mm-hmm. Correct?
Yes, it does.
And it can be really difficult to get the right combinations of medicines mm-hmm. to help the person who's affected.
Absolutely. And that even changes over time as you're talking about an adolescent. You know, as their bodies change, their needs for medication change as well. So you're constantly, you never really get it quite right. You're constantly tinkering. But that requires a surveillance that you know, I was able to do as long as Sophie was living with us and you know, when she was a minor, I was able to have communication with the doctors. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very helpful. For Sophie, it was very, very helpful.
And in Sophie's case, too, the medications had some side effects, which discouraged her from taking them.
Absolutely. Sophie is a very artistic person. She writes beautiful poetry. She's a great actress. She loves to read. And many of the medications would just dull her so that she felt she couldn't write her poetry and she couldn't sing and she couldn't. They just dulled her. They flattened her. Nobody would like that. You know, I contrast that to the experience that my mother, who really suffered from more of the depression piece of manic depression, mm-hmm. the medications that she took relieved her of the depression. And so, you know, who wants to be depressed? Nobody. So you take the medication. Manic-y is a whole another ball game. So manic-y feels good. You're constantly flying to the ceiling, up on the ceiling, and you know, very, very interested in the next feel-good experience. And if you take a medication for that, it dulls it.
So when Sophie turned 18, the gloves were off. What yep. happens when a child who is mentally ill turns 18?
Nothing good. Nothing good. Because at that point, despite the fact that all the doctors agree that in Sophie's case she wasn't able to make decisions, legally she needs to make the decisions. And now we were to a point where when she would be hospitalized, I couldn't talk to the doctors unless she said it was okay.
And she's only 18.
She's only 18. Hmm. She's only 18. Right?
So this led to what for Sophie? You could not participate. You could not force the issue with the medication. What next?
Well, Sophie was hospitalized. She spent a couple of weeks in a psychiatric hospital where she met a heroin addict, and she fell in love with him. in love, I say. She fell in love with this guy. She was convinced he was the love of her life, and she decided she was going to drop out of college, run away from home, and live with the heroin addict. And she did. There was nothing that I could do, nothing that my husband could do to stop her.
She just left home.
She walked out. It was Martin Luther King Day, 2011. She walked out of the house, and that was actually the last time I ever saw her.
Did you beg her to stay?
No, I didn't. I didn't beg her to stay because that would not have been the right answer for her, and it would not have been the right answer for the rest of the family. I was faced with the choice. My husband and I were faced with this horrible choice of encourage her to stay here and bring her heroin addict friends to our home and put our son, who's 4 years younger than Sophie, in danger. And we said, you know, Sophie, we love you more than life itself, but have to draw a line in the sand. And you cannot do that. If you want to live with us, and she was living with us at the time and going to the community college, if you want to live with us, these are the rules. You have to follow the rules. Life is not a picnic without rules. We all have rules.
And as we talked about just a little bit earlier in the show, this touches the entire family. We really hadn't brought Aaron into the conversation. This is your mm-hmm. son, correct?
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
he's also affected by Sophie's mental illness.
Absolutely. He's a very quiet, shy guy who, when our household was escalating around Sophie the whirlwind, would sort of be very quiet. He would do his homework. He was a good doobie. He did his homework, made very few demands on us. But, you know, there were many times where he wouldn't bring his friends home because he didn't want to. She would always usurp his friendships. She would take over. She would, you know, all these little boys who were 4 years younger thought she was adorable and wonderful. And so when his friends came over, she would take over. And so he didn't like that, so he stopped bringing his friends over. So yes, mental illness really takes a toll on everybody in the family, the affected person, the parents, the children. Actually, since Sophie has left us, Aaron, wonderful things have happened for him. Mm-hmm. He has really blossomed. He brings his friends home now. He's about to go off to college, and he's really had the benefit of 4 good years. Without the chaos. It's hard to describe to somebody who hasn't lived it what the house was like. And we were always worried about what Sophie was doing or what she was going to do next or what might she do. And that certainly takes a toll on everybody.
And your husband?
My husband's a saint. He and I, people ask me, how did your marriage survive this?
Yeah.
And you know, if you look at the statistics, mental illness breaks up a lot of marriages. And you know what? I think that for us, we were united in our goal. We both loved Sophie terribly. And we wanted to do what was best for her. So we were united on that front. We talked all the time. We have 2 dogs, and we walk the dogs every morning. And the conversation every morning was all about, you know, what should we do and how should we deal with the situation? And it wasn't always that we agreed. In fact, we had many discussions about where he would say, let's do this, and I would say, let's do that, and then we'd figure out how to deal with it.
Well, we're going to pick up on that in just a moment on Radio Times. We're going to take a short break. Rachel Pruchno is our guest today. She is author of Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. And we're going to get to the phones as well. Our number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Back in just a bit.
LaSalle University's English department offers 2 innovative master's degrees in English, an MA in English for educators that middle and high school teachers may find appealing, and an MA in English in literary and cultural studies that prepare students for a variety of professional careers. For details, 215-951-1100 or lasalle.edu/grad-english. LaSalle University supports WHYY.
On a November morning in 1979, computers at the underground command center of the Strategic Air Command sent an alarming message.
Suddenly, the screens were filled with images of a major Soviet attack on the United States.
It turned out to be a false alarm, but it wasn't the only one. On the next Fresh Air, Eric Schlosser discusses his book, Command and Control. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
What is wisdom? It's said we gain wisdom as we age, but as we age, our cognitive ability declines. So what's the answer? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about wisdom as we age, what it is, how to gain it, how to use it, and how to keep it. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is WHYY in Philadelphia at Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. We are talking about mental illness and how it affects families. Our guest is Rachel Pruchno, author of Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. And our number is 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org is where you can send us an email, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's get to the phones. Phil, in Center City, you've been very patient. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Oh, pleasure to be with you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think it's a truly fascinating story, and also at the same time heartbreaking. And I'm sorry if it's just a little bit off topic, but as I was listening, I'm just very curious as to whether any of the perpetrators that abused Sophie were ever brought to justice. The person from the camp, or this grifter, or any other people.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, great question. So Sophie would not tell us the name of the person at the camp. My husband contacted the camp director and let him know what we had learned, but really hard to go after somebody whose name we didn't have. So that was very frustrating. In terms of Grinner, we did get the police involved. And again, in order for a report of police a charge to be made, Sophie had to cooperate, and she just wouldn't give him up.
Hmm.
So, you know, how heartbreaking is that for a parent to live with that? That was her decision. She was a minor, but we couldn't make her talk.
To not bring this person to justice.
Nope. So he's still out there. Both of them are still out there.
We have an email from Susan. She says, I feel like this is my story. I am glad that this is discussed. I thought it was somewhat isolated to our situation. Thanks. I'm sure others think the same thing. And again, there's that word, isolation.
Yeah. Thank you, Susan. That's why I wrote the book, because there are so many people like you and like me out there, and we all think we're the only ones, and we're not. So it's so prevalent, and it's amazing that something so prevalent is not talked about.
In an article you wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer a couple of weeks back, you talk about some legislation sponsored by Congressman Tim Murphy that would, among other things, enable the parents of mentally ill adult children to talk to their child's physicians. And mm-hmm. And Marty's going to address this issue more fully down the road with a number of different voices, but I wanted to get your perspective.
Yeah, I think that that's critical. There are a lot of interesting pieces to Murphy's bill, but I think that for me, as a parent, I think that is the most important one. And this is not to say that we're going to usurp the child's rights to make decisions. And again, we're talking about the adult child, the person who's 18 or older. But when the person is in crisis, somebody, it could be a parent, it could be a sibling, it could be a beloved aunt or uncle, somebody who cares about the person really needs to be involved in decision-making and talking to the physicians. And if only to give information about the past. You know, I think now about Sophie, who's out there somewhere. If and when she finds her way to an emergency room, and she knows how to get to an emergency room, all you have to say is, I'm feeling suicidal, and you get attention.
Mm-hmm.
She did that. She did that many times when she lived with me. But once she makes her way there, she won't be able to give a complete history to the physician. If the physician doesn't have a complete history, how is he supposed to diagnose and treat?
So if you had been able to be at the table when she turned 18, what would you have brought to her treatment and possible healing, do you think?
Well, I think...
The history, obviously.
The history, the support. People with mental illness need support. They need loved ones to support them. And, you know, it's what they're dealing with. It's very, very difficult, whether they're dealing with schizophrenia or with bipolar disorder. These thought disorders and mood disorders really need the support of loved ones. So that's critical.
Again, because quite often they don't know they're ill
when they're
in the middle of it.
Unfortunately, that's one of the big problems with these serious mental illnesses, that the people who suffer from them don't understand how ill they are. Sophie did not understand, and she would always poo-poo when, you know, I would say, you know, make sure you take your medicine or smoking marijuana is not a good idea. It contradicts the medications you're on. So, I think that really needing the support from people who love them.
And sometimes when the mentally ill end up on the street, as Sophie has, they self-medicate.
That's right. And that's what she's doing now. We rarely hear from Sophie, but I do know that she is addicted to meth. She's living on the streets, and she's in and out of jail. I mean,
this is horrible.
So I think that you know, part of what Murphy's Bill does is to say we need to treat people with mental illness, and we need to treat them with respect. You know, the history of dealing with people with mental illness goes back hundreds of years, and we've never done it right. And I think what we've always done wrong, whether it be the snake pits of institutions or the homelessness now, is we don't treat these people with respect. And I think that's critical. And I think Murphy begins to bring respect back into it.
All right,
for people.
We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let's go to Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Sharon, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So what is your thought, Sharon? What's your story?
I think, well, there's many, many thoughts that I have related to this. I had a daughter who was also diagnosed as ADHD when she was very young in third grade. No, actually in kindergarten. And then she was diagnosed later on as bipolar. And one of the things that I experienced that was very different from the person who's talking is I ran into a lot of psychiatrists who got really stuck on the idea of there was an exclusive relationship between them and my daughter, and they would not include me in anything.
Rachel Pucino, you're nodding your head.
I am. Yes, and that was my experience as well. So, for a therapeutic relationship to work, the child needs to feel safe talking to the doctor, and that was made very clear to me. And that was the case for us as well, where the psychiatrist or the psychologist could step outside of that is if the child was doing anything to put herself or somebody else in danger. And that was the case with Sophie. When the psychologist realized that Sophie was planning to sneak out of the house to meet a pervert, she needed to break that therapeutic bond and let us as the parents know, because Sophie was a minor at the time. But you're right, you know, and how frustrating is that as a parent to be totally left out of that doctor-patient relationship, but for the child to feel safe, for the relationship really to work, that's what needs to happen.
Sharon, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Nancy, you're next. Hello, Nancy. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
My daughter, Sarah, is a duplicate of Sophie. She was three weeks old when we adopted her. And, again, at a very young age, we realized that something was not quite right. She, in high school, refused to go to school, so she dropped out after the ninth grade. We had no support at school. She would sneak out of the house, jump out of windows, go see her friends. And in our case, the police were no help whatsoever. They told us she was a Lolita and that she this is what she wanted to do, and they would not arrest or try to find the men that she was with.
A Lolita, huh?
Yeah. And, excuse me, and she was in and out of jail. She would go to New York, Washington with a gun and buy drugs. But the whole thing is the whole time, my husband and I were very united, very caring, very concerned about her, did everything we could at the time, because she's 35 now, so this was, you know, years ago. Everything we could with the resources we had at the time. Now she understands she has problems. She's a wonderful adult. She works with mentally ill, which is, I think, a blessing for them, because she understands their situation. And she's a mom. She actually did not want to get pregnant because she didn't want to pass on her she called bad genes. But she is a wonderful person now.
Nancy, I'm curious. It sounds as if something that helped you make it through in your family were your resources. What were they?
Well, for one, we needed it for ourselves. We went through tough love. And at the time, that was the thing that brought my husband and I so we would be stand as united and firm. But we never, the only resources was we had her in a foundation for several months. Again, she did some things there she wasn't supposed to, but she got her GED when she was there. You talk about the brilliance of these kids. She was a beautiful artist. She the counselors at the foundation said, we want you to get your GED. She goes, okay. She took it, passed it, flying colors, at ninth grade education.
So a story with a happy ending, Nancy?
Yes.
Rachel?
That's great. I'm so happy for you. So was there something that turned her around?
I think just our constant, every time something happened, she knew she could come back to us. She couldn't live with us, but she could come back to us mm-hmm. every time something happened. And she even comments to this day that we never used bad language with her, we never scolded her, we never hit her. And they're the things that she brings with her now that she realizes that she had that united front with me and my husband.
Nancy, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. They sound like an enormously strong family, but many families, you know, I'm sure would buckle under the weight of this sort of situation. So let's talk about resources for mm-hmm. families. Counseling, what can families do to try to get themselves through this, Rachel?
Well, I wish I had an easy answer and a quick response to that, but I fear that there really aren't easy answers. I think what I would suggest that people do is first, don't hide. Talk to a friend. Get the support that exists in your natural world. That's the first thing. No secrets. I think we just got to stop doing secrets. Secondly, I think that I would suggest that people get involved with NAMI, the National Association for Mental Illness. That's a grassroots organization that provides support groups and education. I think that's very helpful for families. And third, I think I would suggest that people tell your congressman to support Murphy's bill. At this point, it's a bipartisan bill, support from both Democrats and Republicans. And I think that it's a step in the right direction to addressing some of the problems that we see.
Let's get back to the phones. Emily in Glassboro, New Jersey, has been very patient, standing by. Hi, Emily.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually had a pretty similar story to Sophie's myself. I was diagnosed bipolar in my junior year of college, actually. And I had an experience similar to Sophie's where when I was put in a program, a psychiatric program, I was in that program with lots of people who had some severe drug addiction issues. And I remember thinking how easy it could have been to go down that path and to kind of end up, you know, I had a little bit of drug abuse, but to end up in harder things. And I was wondering how much of an effect you think that had on Sophie's path eventually to drug addiction, and if you think that if something could have been different in there, if she hadn't met those people, if she had just been with mentally ill people, if you think it would have been different.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah, I have thought that many times. When Sophie was in high school and she made friends with people who smoked cigarettes, she started smoking cigarettes. And then when she went to the psychiatric facility and she started making friends with people who were doing heroin and hard drugs, and then she started to do those or get interested in those drugs. So, you know, I was amazed that when she was. Just 18. She was not 18. She was 17 and a half. She got put on a unit, a dual diagnosis unit, and on that unit were because that's where there was a bed. But on that unit there were people who were addicted to drugs, had committed crimes, and here we have this. She's there because she tested positive for marijuana. And she had a history of mental illness. So you have this, you know, sweet little girl from the suburbs in this amazing environment.
So in a perfect world, where would she have been?
In a perfect world, she would have been in a unit that was focused on people like her mm-hmm. with mental illness. You know, I think one of the biggest concerns that I had was, as I said earlier, when she was in a psychiatric hospital, she saw this as a place to meet men. And the fact that the staff all knew, in fact, one of the nurses called me, and it was kind of funny. She said, oh, yeah, we have our own little budding romance going on here. And Sophie and this guy were scheduled to be released at the same time, and they were going to go on a date.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah, that's a huge problem. So as soon as the staff saw that, they should have been separated. And they didn't. They just laughed.
You were told that Sophie needed to hit rock bottom before she would want to seek help. No, it's been several years mm-hmm. since she walked out your front door. What do you think rock bottom would be for Sophie? I'm assuming she hasn't hit it yet because you really only hear from her sporadically,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. I have asked myself that many times. I don't believe she has a rock bottom. Or if she has a rock bottom, will she hit it before she kills herself? You know, very, very, very frustrating to be told by the doctors that as a parent, you know, you can't make it all better. You can't rescue them, that they have to hit rock bottom. And when you're talking with somebody with a serious mental illness, we wouldn't do that with somebody with diabetes or leukemia. So you have to hit rock bottom before we can treat you. Yet we say this because we don't know what else to say, that we're relying on the person to know, to have that insight many people with serious mental illnesses will never have.
In the book, you say, part of the person I'd been for so long, Sophie's mom, no longer existed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way you feel? You just have had to set Sophie's mom aside?
I have, because, you know, part of it was that I had to go on, and I had to be Aaron's mom, and I had to be Josh's wife, and I had to have a career, and you know, once a person, you know, but when a person with mental illness is a child, you can help and protect them. When they become an adult, if you stick with them, they can destroy you.
All right, Rachel Pruchno, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Pruchno is the author of the book Surrounded by Madness, a memoir of mental illness and family secrets. Don't forget to visit our Facebook page, and you can also find our podcasts by heading to our homepage, whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moscowane. Thanks so much for joining us.